And hello again. Welcome to Scots Radio. I'm Freda Morrison, and welcome to this programme that celebrates the Scots language and the Scots culture. If you've just found us, bide wi' us. In this edition, we're oot and aboot in the Scottish countryside. Roon aboot. There's a definite environmental theme in this programme. I'm doing in Dunbar, enjoying the Coastward Festival. Dunbar, of course, is the birthplace of John Muir, born there in 1838. John Muir was the internationally renowned Scottish-American naturalist who is referred to as the Father of National Parks and the National Park Ranger Service in the United States. And I'm joined in the studio by our man of the woods, our very own David Mitchell. Also on the programme, we join our countryside ranger, Fred Gordon, on the Smuggler's Road in Strathdon in Aberdeenshire. And we're on the other side of the North East in Pitsligga, among the boats and the peat bogs, with singer-songwriter Pete Coots. And that's where we begin with Pete's music. His new album, Northern Sky, that's our featured album this month. And this is for that album, an instrumental, Ala Thumpach. Beautiful. Ala Thumpach from the new album from Pete Coots' Northern Sky, our featured album this month. Now, I had the great pleasure of joining the audiences at the Coastward Festival in Dunbar, not that long ago. And it was a fantastic community event. We community choirs and writers and poets and songwriters and musicians, threw with her. Now, Dunbar was where internationally renowned conservationist and writer John Muir was born. And as I said, he is referred to as the father of national parks and the Park Ranger Service. This service started in 1916, so this year the United States of America is celebrating the centenary year of the National Park Ranger Service. So before we go to Dunbar, let me introduce my studio guest, past curator of the Edinburgh Botanics and the Man of the Woods, Dave Mitchell. Welcome back, Dave.
It's lovely to be here, Frieda. It's just fair grand to be back and hearing a bit blether about important things.
And blether about important things, that's it. But John Muir, who is he?
Muir's an awful well-known figure now, but, you know, 25, 30 years ago, near that many folk had heard of him.
25, 30, you would think?
Even as recently that, you know, he was well-known in America, but he wasn't as well-known here. He was an awful complicated man, a complex character. But early in his life, he discovered how important the healing and energising power of nature was for each and every one of us. He recognised that going out into nature was good for his own well-being and for the recharging of his batteries. I mean, a wee phrase here for his book on our national parks: climb the mountains and get their good tidings. Nature's peace will follow into you as sunshine flows into the trees. The winds will blow their own freshness into you and the storms their energy, while the cares will drop away from you like leaves.
You have a why with words as well, you see, Davy Mitchell. Let's get back to the nuts and bolts, though. Right back to Dunbar. Right.
Well, Muir was born there, and, you know, I think he became... The place influenced his life. I mean, his early childhood, he was deeply rooted in the natural world. Growing up there, he hated the tyranny of the school and, you know, grammar and religious teaching. He liked to get out on the beach and hunt among the rock pools for crabs and stars and jellyfish and wee anemones and things. And, oh, he liked playing on the old castle walls and round the cliffs at Dunbar Castle there. There's stories in his own book, My Boyhood and Youth, about him playing soldiers and reenacting the wars of independence and things like that. But he often sneaked out of the house at night to get away and gone out birds nesting. And he wasn't prone to fighting with other boys and being a wee bit kind of strong.
He had to put up for himself because he was the third of eight children, wasn't he?
That's
big,
right.
Big family.
He had a big family. He came from a big family, and he'd had to fight for his own place in that family and his own place in the world.
Family, father, deeply religious.
Oh, his father was a very religious man. In fact, he took the family to the United States because he believed the Church of Scotland had insufficient strict faith and practice. He wanted a new start for his family in Wisconsin, where they would be even more strictly brought up than what they were here.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he was 11 years old when he moved to Wisconsin.
From what we know, his father just came home one night and says, well, we're all going to America the next day, as you do. Didn't he tell the boy anything till he needs to know.
So he emigrated, and that was that, the start of something. And then we'll move on a wee bit further.
He grew up on the farm in Wisconsin, and he enjoyed that time because there was a lot of freedom and space and what have you. He did chores today like Onnie Byrne, but he developed a love of machines and inventing things. And he even exhibited some of his machines at the Wisconsin Agricultural Fair. But he later went to university in Wisconsin. He paid for it himself. He paid his own way through university, and he studied chemistry and botany and geology. He actually ended up in a factory about 1886. However, in 1867, he was temporarily blinded in an accident, and the Bear Manning had to sit in a room, lie in a room for 6 weeks in the dark. And they didn't think he would see again. Imagine the fear in him when he was like that, man that loved nature.
But that was the catalyst, wasn't it?
That was the catalyst that changed his life and gave him the power to, as he said, when he eventually recovered his sight, I saw the world with a new light and a new purpose. And that's what made him go on a 1,000-mile walk to the Gulf.
Now we're going to come back to that in a minute. So thanks, Dave, because it leads me back to Dunbar and a fascinating talk by Will Collin. Now, Will is one of the trustees of the John Muir Birthplace in Dunbar. He'll like this. And after the session, as the musicians set up for the next performance in the background, a giant committee member, John Hardman, to speak at Will, made about John Muir. Will said John Muir was the most important immigrant to come out of Scotland. Sid, why did you think that?
Well, I tried to give part of the reason in my talk. I think that he has changed the way that the world looks at conservation. Before Muir, it was very much a case of grab what you could, and it didn't matter what you did to the land as a result. And he saw that with the miners, with the loggers, and with the sheep herders in California. Mm-hmm. And he realised that if things weren't changed, the whole of the west coast of the United States, and as a result, the rest of the United States, would be devoid of any
just
original
destroyed,
scenery.
Just destroyed. Yeah. Now, I've invited John Hardman to join us because he was asking you questions that I wanted to ask myself. I'll ask John to ask that question again about his voice.
The original question I asked was whether there were any surviving recordings of John Muir's voice, and the main reason I was curious about that was to understand whether John Muir retained his Scots accent.
Exactly. Any light on that, Will?
Well, there is no recording that anybody that I know, and people in the Sierra Club, for example, are not aware of any recordings. Recording of the human voice was in place, but there's none with John Muir. But there is loads of evidence that John Muir was first and foremost a Scot, and that he spoke with a Scottish accent, because loads of people have said that. You have written that he had a Scots burr.
But he was very fond of Robert Burns as well. He was a big fan of Robert Burns, quoted Robert Burns.
When his wife died in 1905, John Muir kind of stepped back from publicity. And then on the 25th of January of 1906, he sat down at his desk in his scribble den and he wrote an essay, Thoughts Written on the Birthday of Robert Burns. And in it, he said that Burns had been with him everywhere he went, that when Muir was out on his own, he would recite Burns' poetry, he would sing Burns' songs, and he wrote, the animals and the trees all seemed to love them.
That's remarkable as well, John. I think you must agree that the fact that it puts a different slant on the man himself, John Muir, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's one of the things that you don't think about. What did he sound like? But he also had a very good friend that was from Aberdeenshire. I picked up on this, of course, being from Aberdeenshire myself. Who was that?
That was William Keith. William Keith emigrated to America when he was 12. He had been born the same year as John Muir at Old Meldrum in Aberdeenshire, John Muir a few months before down in Dunbar. They met in 1872 in Yosemite. Muir, by this time, was acting as a guide, and Keith and two other Scottish artists, as it happened, had been given a letter of introduction and sought out Muir, and Muir took them out to places that were worth painting. But there was a friendship, an immediate rapport between Keith and Muir, and they remained friends for the rest of Keith's life. Died in 1911. There's no doubt that Muir, wherever he went, if he could find a fellow Scot, he would talk in Scots to them. But Muir and Keith lived within about 20 miles of each other. They met weekly if they were both in the area, and they would love to, because it's recorded, both of them have said that they would love to talk together in Scots. And of course, not all the company knew what they were saying in Scots, and so one or other of them would give a translation so that the rest could keep up with what they were talking about.
Setting up for the next session at Coast Word here, so we've only got a few seconds probably with Will. You think of questions. My last question is, what is the significance now then? We're now on the anniversary the National Park anniversary in the States. What is John Muir's significance now?
I think John Muir has become more significant since his death. I don't think his significance has reduced. If you think that the John Muir Trust in Britain was founded in 1980, whatever, and has grown since and now manages somewhere in excess of 60,000 acres of wild areas of Scotland. If you think that the John Muir Way from Dunbar to Helensburgh was opened in 2014 and is attracting huge numbers of people, not just from Scotland, but from abroad, from the United States, from other countries, and they're walking a way that's in memory of John Muir. But you know, his message is one that, although it was made 100 years ago, is still relevant. Back in 1896, he wrote that the world is getting warmer. All of the world's glaciers are shrinking. We're eventually cottoning on to this being a serious problem. And Muir didn't just give the problems, because he gave ways of solving the problems. He was saying as long ago as that, that if you cut down all the trees, you're going to increase the risk of flooding. And gosh, we found that out to our cost.
John, last word from you.
I was going to ask, what does John Muir mean for Dunbar as time goes on in the future? Though to some degree you've answered that in saying that he matters to all of us.
I think that there's a need for the Dunbar community at large to realise just how important this fella is, not just for America, but for Dunbar, for East Lothian, for Scotland. If it's for no other reason, it's a huge tourist boost to the area. But you know, he's far much more important than that.
Will Collin talking about John Muir, and thank you too to John Hardman for joining us there and the hospitality at the Coast World Festival. This is Pete Coots from his new album, Song from the Coast, since we're at the coast in Dunbar. This is Sail and Oar.
He's leaving hame for the refuge the chained hands made. Number a thousand strong, they plant their bows out east, like the Scotty's eye for the feast. Putting the nets to draft, the lifeline to the deep, 60 fathoms in the Blackdale Sea. Oh, the nets teeming o'er, hands as course as stained, and we are strong ere the sea we'll tame. With the wind at our backs and the wide ocean calling, a waffy the blue tune was sailing o'er. Oh, the sea's thick with silver, we haul in the prize and we'll count in the crown, we sailing o'er. Tour the darlings in by een, heave em up and lay em baskets low. With the wind at our backs and the wide ocean calling, a waffy the blue tune was sailing o'er. Oh, the sea's thick with silver, we haul in the prize and we'll count in the crown, be sailing o'er. The boats are weighing low, the gutton quine is wide by the shore. Rowing into port to hear the cooper loons, chaffing rhythms, oh, the hammers roar. With the wind at our backs and the wide ocean calling, a wafting of blue tune we're sailing o'er. Oh, the sea's thick with silver, we haul in the prize and we'll count in a crown. We're sailing o'er with the wind at our backs and the wide ocean calling, a wafting of blue tune we're sailing o'er. Oh, the sea's thick with silver, we haul in the prize and we'll count in a crown. We're sailing o'er.
Fair featured album, his new note, Northern Sky. It's a cracker. And if you've just joined us, bide with us. This is Frieda Morrison and this is Scots Radio. And with me in the studio is Davey Mitchell, past Edinburgh Botanic Curator. And I was doing at the Coastward Festival in Dunbar. That's the birthplace of conservationist and writer John Muir. And we were earlier speaking about the great man, and this being the centennial year of the National Park Service that he is credited as setting up, along with the national parks. Dave, back to you again. What made him, as I said, the father of national parks?
Simply passion for nature, enthusiasm, superb communication skills, especially his use of language and storytelling. His knowledge was vast of botany and geology and birds and mammals and zoology, all sorts of stuff. But he had a really strong desire to ensure that the world was protected so that other people could enjoy what he'd enjoyed. And he used his language to be able to get that across to other people. But, you know, he was very concerned about industrialisation and deforestation that he was witnessing. So that Scotch grit and determination, that Again, Scottish stubbornness and the gentle gift of no being able to duck no for an answer.
That's a very unusual characteristic in the Scots.
I think he had that. He was a real advocate for nature. He was a voice for things that couldn't speak for themselves. But I think he had a significant command of the English language, despite his lack of interest in grammar as a bairn. It must have been thrashed into him, you know. And he mixed that with the Scotch tongue, and I think he had a mesmerising, almost mystical effect on people when he sat down to talk to them.
He had an amazing memory, apparently. I can mind Will telling us that he could recite huge, massive chunks of the Bible.
He reputedly was able to recite most of the Old Testament, mm-hmm, and virtually all of the New Testament by the age of 11.
It's incredible.
And I can imagine him being able to recite Burns' poetry, but I think one of the things that what made him father of the national parks was a wonderful man, Robert B. Marshall, who was the chief geographer for the US Geological Survey, and he summed Muir up by saying, "His simplicity was his power."
A lovely phrase.
And I think Muir was able to take nature and he was able to distill what he'd seen on his saunters and his donnerns round about the hills and the valleys and the mountains. And he was able to distill all that and put it into words that somehow inspired others. Because, he loved sleeping out under the stars. He enjoyed the wilderness and the roar of nature in a thunderstorm and the lightning and the rain. He loved the views from the peaks and the glimpse of a meadow through a wood, the sheer scale and the space, the remoteness, and the silence that was melded with the sound of birds or the glimpse of a wee deer and our fawns through the trees.
Because he liked to wander about his saunters, his good garden.
He undertook a lifetime of walks and journeys, from the thousand-mile walk to going to Alaska, to his first summer in the Sierra, to his trips into the Californian mountains, to his time in the glaciers in Alaska. You know, a lot of people don't know, but he even went to Asia and to Africa and to the Amazon, you know, later in
life. Just to see things, but open spaces.
But it was the way that he could take what he saw with his eyes and turn to the point that he even commented on the sound of a snowflake falling.
A beautiful thought.
And he observed everything in great detail and put it into his books, well, the very first of which was actually Our National Parks, which was published in 1901. That was the one that really hurt out. You know, the story of his boyhood and youth wasn't published till 1913.
Can I just establish that the first national park that was set up was Yellowstone, wasn't it? Well, it was 1872.
Yellowstone was actually founded in 1872 and protected by law by President Ulysses E. Grant. But it was actually managed by the Army for the first 30 to 40 years before it was the actual national parks themselves were founded by President Woodrow Wilson. They were put into law by him. But actually, Muir's role in all of this, he actually got an American president to come camping with him. He brought Theodore Roosevelt in 1903 to Yosemite Valley and Mariposa Grove and said, you know, why is this not in the national park? It should be. And he persuaded Roosevelt to actually put it into the national park in Yosemite. He took him to the Grand Canyon and, of course, they went back to Yellowstone. So Muir very much in the he used his voice and he used what he observed and his voice and his ability to write. He used that as a political lever to inspire others, to come and see him, to take them and show them these things for themselves. And, you know, he also was one of the founders of the Sierra Club. There was 182 members initially. Now there's 2.5 million.
Fantastic. Can I tell you that I've actually been to the Yellowstone National Park?
You've been to Yellowstone?
I've been. I remember we were looking, I think it's the Old Faithful or the geysers. And we turned around and we were surrounded by buffalo, just suddenly surrounded by buffalo. It was a magical moment, Eddie.
I think one of my most magical moments there was actually to be in Zumwalt Meadow on a big log, where Muir had been.
Absolutely.
Very, very early in the morning. And just, you could almost hear his voice when you stood there so quiet on your own.
I'm going to just stop for a wee minty, to catch breath and let you listen to this little bit of music I've chosen specially for you, because it's something I think you'll identify with. And just to remind you, you're listening to Scots Radio. This is Freda Morrison. With me in the studio is horticulturalist and naturalist Davy Mitchell. And this is fiddler Alistair Fraser and Paul Machlis on piano with the Rosebud o' Allan Vale.
Thank you.
Isn't that just beautiful? Absolutely.
Yeah, I wonder if Muir had a love of music. I've never
He's
seen
bound
it.
To hear
he
that.
Must have done.
As you can hear, I am not on my own this month. I'm joined in the studio by our very own David Mitchell, horticulturalist and man of the woods. That was Alistair Fraser and Paul Machlis for the Rosebud O'Allan Vale from their CD, Legacy of the Scottish Fiddle, Volume 1. And David and I were speaking about the legacy left from all the wanderings and the writings of the conservationist John Muir. David, I'm going to go back to you. What do you think his legacy is?
I think it would be wrong to sum up Muir's legacy just as the physical things, kind of thousands and millions of acres that are preserved and all the biodiversity in them, the Sierra Club, which, you know, 2.4 million members, and the John Muir Trust and all the good work they do here in Scotland, let alone the John Muir Award, which, you know, 250,000 people of all ages have now got a John Muir Award. That's a huge legacy. But for me personally, Muir's greatest legacy is his ability to reach deep inside us even now, reminding us that we all have a free spirit if we're willing to look for it and grow it and develop it. And the best place to find that free spirit is to go back to nature, to wild places, to the wild wood. You can hear him almost, listen. In his words, going to the woods is going home. For I suppose we came for the woods originally. There's nae doubt about it. Tucking a saunter in the woods will do you good. For as Muir said, a tree does good like medicine, enriching the air with rosin and balsam, and its beauty and type of steadfast strength makes one feel immortal.
Right, just again, nuts and bolts. He came my kind of desire for nuts and bolts. We've got two national parks in Scotland. That's the Loch Lomond and the Trossachs, and we've got the Cairngorm National Park. And as I said, we were speaking about John Muir, father of national parks, and the National Park Ranger Service, this being the centennial year or the Ranger Service in the States. And we, of course, hate countryside rangers as well, Davy, in Scotland. And one of them was my good pal and new esteemed member of the programme team, I'm proud to say, Fred Gordon. Now, Fred was a ranger with Aberdeenshire Council for over 20 years, and he opened my eyes, and he'd, a few years ago, to the stories. Now, you mentioned that, the stories of the landscape. It's the stories in the landscape in Scotland that I love. And I loved hearing Fred's stories ever since. So I joined up with Fred again in the beautiful wilderness that is Glen Nochty in the Cairngorm National Park to hear mair about the whisky smugglers. Fred paints the scene. Farabouts are with Fred.
Well, we're up at the head of Glen Nochty. And if you look over to across my shoulder here, you can see the line of the ladder hills covered with snow. And this is the road that the whisky smugglers came across from Glenlivet, which is just the other side of those hills and is, of course, well known for quite a number of different whiskies.
Oh, right. So there's Glenlivet up yonder, and there's Fitzahinmon then?
Well, Fitzahinmon there, Frida, is looking towards the Licht Ski Centre and over towards Speyside, and to behind us here is the road to Afford. So the cattle and the whisky that was coming across here on the old drove road was coming from Glenlivet over the Ladder Hills, then down into Glen Nochty, then down to the marts at Afford.
See, you didn't realise just how busy these hills would have been.
Oh, heavens,
aye,
there were hundreds of people lived up here that time. It wasn't empty. Everybody regards this quarter now as completely devoid of folk. In fact, we've got just up from us here, we've got the Lost Gallery, which is an art gallery run by artist Peter Goodfellow.
So they would come over, the smugglers would come over these hills with their ponies, barrels on either side of the saddle.
Aye, that's the way it worked. They would have two or three ponies and a barrel on each side. So they had quite a few gallons of whisky, and it was worth a lot of money to them.
No, it would have been fairly risky because there's a lot of excise money going about at that time. Did they have a really complicated emergency signalling system?
Well, it wasn't complicated. In fact, it was half a simple, really. They would send a couple of young lads up and onto the ladder hills, and there's a wee notch in the ladder hills that we can see for here. Yeah. And these lads would spend the day up there when they were making the whisky, and they would build a wee fire. And if they they saw somebody they didn't recognise who might be an exciseman. These wee lads would light the fire, and the lads who were making the whisky, they would have one eye on the hill and one eye on the whisky making. Mm-hmm. And if they saw the fire, they would pack everything up so that when the whisky man got there, there was nothing to see.
So you can see the Snarkamananu of these hills now. Just, you can imagine just how remote and bleak sometimes it would have been. But this is the very place you would hear illicit stills in, isn't
it? Oh, aye, yeah. And in fact, there probably are one or two stills still hidden in the hills. Not in use, but they would still be there, just being forgotten about, lost.
So fit in the time when we're speaking about, Fred?
We're speaking about, it's difficult to say when it started, but probably the 1600s, 1700s, into the 1800s. And they would have still been taking the whisky over the hills, even at that late stage.
Now, you mentioned the cattle coming over from Afford, the Afford Market. Would they be rumbling in and through their are together so that it would be difficult to identify if fit was fit?
I think they would, because a lot of the cattle drovers, they had ponies. And if they had the ponies with the whisky in amongst the cattle, the excisemen would have taken less interest in them. And if the excisemen came along, they could drop these whisky barrels very, very quickly off the ponies and hide them in the heather, and now they could egg them back and get them later on.
And Mackie on, they were just cattle drovers?
Mackie on, they're just with the cattle drovers. It's honest men going about their business.
You can just imagine them coming back and forth. This very road would just come up.
They would. And the thing to remember is the cattle were worth a lot of money, but the whisky was probably worth more, because they were taking the whisky to the whisky-hungry markets in the South.
Edinburgh and Glasgow?
Edinburgh, Glasgow, and further afield. Oh. If you can remember, down in England, they had the Industrial Revolution going on at part of this time, and they would have been looking for whisky and so on as well.
Because huge market,
and they probably couldn't have made enough. They made for themselves, but they also made a lot of money out of the markets in the South.
You can just imagine the parties that were going on. In fact, you mentioned just not far from here, there's quite a renowned, dance hall.
There was a big house down here at the head of Glen Nochty, and the owner built a dance hall which was reckoned to be the best dance hall in the northeast of Scotland at one time. It had half a good flair, and he had a ball. Can you imagine a ball away up here?
And
the ball had apparently hundreds of folk at it. So that would have been quite a night to be in, and I'm sure there would have been a wee bit of whiskey drunk at that as well.
So you had a huge dance in the Land of the Lost.
The Land of the Lost had its day. But I think the history of this, a lot of it remains untold. Bob Smith, the well-known northeast author, he wrote a book of The Land of the Lost. Aye. And I'm sure he had a lot of stories that didn't make it into the book.
In fact, I interviewed Bob when he took that book out first.
Aye.
It was a great book. Fred, thanks for this. The rain's coming on, Bucket and Doon. And we can just imagine them coming over that hill and the ponies... And are with us.
Aye, and we're ready for a dram.
Ready for a dram. And much enjoyed it was tea. Snarkamin' doon the glen, swirling roon and roon in the gloaming of a northern sky. I love storms. Thanks, Fred, for that. And back with our featured album this month. But before I say that, we're speaking about illicit stills, Dave. And of course, I wrote about this. Fred was saying illicit stills. And I wrote about me and Deeside. It was renowned for its illicit stills. And there's a song called The Yowie with the Crooked Horn that was written next door to Far Abide New. And I remember me and an half a young musician called Fraser Fifield had to go into BBC studios to record The Yowie with the Crooked Horn for the education department, the CNBC. And it was part of an educational programme for primary schools. And when I heard the programme, I just about fainted because the script read, and the farmers thought so much of their animals that they even wrote songs about them. And this was The Yowie with the Crooked Horn, when I had to phone the producer up quick and say, no, it was a euphemism for the illicit still. It wasn't a wood of sheep. So there's a whole generation of bairns thinking, oh my goodness. Right, far was I. Back to Pete Coots, for we'll hear fae after this. And it's an instrumental card. In a note. Pete Coots for his new album Northern Sky. And Peter's fae New Pitsligger, near the Mormont Hill in Buchan, Aberdeenshire. Nae far fae Peterhead in Fraserburgh. That's the other side of the country, fae far we were with Fred. He's been a full-time musician most of his working life. He knew touring in Germany with the band Ballad of Crows. And Pete was hame recently, showing us his new album. And I managed to catch up with him for a blether. Pete is writing songs in a mixture of Doric and English, as you heard. Why has he chosen to do the songs? That why.
I mean, a few folk have said to me, "Oh, why have you said a phrase in Doric there and in nay, it's a Doric there?" And I thought, well, it's about fit sounds good and fit rhymes.
Doesn't it sound contrived? Because that's the way we speak. Half sometimes it depends on the register.
Well, that's it. I mean, I was visiting my family in Pitsligger last night, and it was like, well, and with my girlfriend in Germany, and she's just starting to understand me properly. And last night was like an advanced Doric language course. And just when I thought she was getting the hang of it, and I was like, oh, do you understand that? And last night visiting the family, she was like, I got a clue if it's being said. No. I wanted it to be accessible. And still be still tell the story, still use the language, but just nae be really broad, still
nae be exclusive.
Aye.
That's the thing. It's a fine balance, isn't it?
Aye. I also didn't think I did it on purpose. It was just the way it came out.
It's just why you speak.
It was just the way.
Because I was sitting up in Glenbucket Hall not that long ago, last week. Was it only last week? Last week, listening to you mm-hmm. and Paddy, you and Paddy Whitehead, and. It's just the way you present it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's the way you write. Mm-hmm. That's what's in your songs, isn't it? And mm-hmm. you're drawn for your own experiences as well, at mm-hmm. least. It's stories for your own family, isn't it?
It is, aye. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how it came about. My dad would always tell me this really, really interesting stories for his childhood and his family history, so therefore my family history. And I just thought it was fascinating. And it just took me a long time to kind of come round to the idea this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to play folk music. I wanted to write about something that was connected to me. As far as you can, you can sing about cruising down Route 66 if that's fit you do. But I've never been in Route 66, so and I wouldn't have came fit to write about that, or I couldn't have put my hair into it. It was something that I've kind of in a boot.
But for why do we not sing the local northeast ballads or northeast folk songs? But that they just keep you happy.
I'm fairly new to it. Like I say, I'm fairly new to the folk music, well, to Scottish folk music, and it was fun starting to listen to folk ballads and getting involved with like sort of Scat and Elvis Institute, just doing a few things here and there. And playing Kayleys and that I was just getting more involved, and so that was mere, again, rather than I reckon it just that happened, almost by accident. Like I say, the album was like researching my family history and that, and I thought, oh, that would make a good song, and before I kent myself, I had a couple of tunes, and I thought, well, that's an album.
It's a harder thing to do, though, Pete, isn't it? It's mere. I'm thinking of the word. It's a chuch road you've chosen.
Oh, it's fair chuch, aye.
It's a chuching.
Aye.
You've got that idea new, mm-hmm. and I think somebody said, I think it was Paddy, that says you're a perfectionist.
Well.
You've got everything sorted, everything just honed in fine. But just when you were about to think about launching it again, you moved to Germany.
That's right, all right. That kind of put a wee spanner in the works and kind of made everything just a little bit harder to mm-hmm. deal with. Through the magical technology and the internet, I was able just to send sort of files to folk and then send back to me, and that kind of worked too fine.
And then you become a dad.
That's right, aye.
So that was complicating things again.
Aye.
Nicely complicating things again. And when you're looking back for Germany, what did you see for the Northeast? What's going through your head? Is it better to write songs for there?
Well, actually, Bell Healthy was written sitting on the Rhine. funnily enough, Ken, and I was look, back with a romantic view of things.
I'm thinking, the writers that went away abroad, like Charles Murray for the Northeast, he's looking back and they're writing, James Leslie Mitchell, Sunset Song, he's writing Fair Distance again. Does it help to write Fair Distance, you think?
I never really thought about that. I mean, I suppose that obviously, when you're away from home and you're maybe feeling a bit homesick, or like I say, you have more of a romantic view, or it, maybe it helps you. It's a bit closer to your heart, and that can maybe that just adds a little something to it, I suppose.
Right, I'm not going to say if it's my favourite thing is in the album, and I'm not going to try and influence anybody else's favourite, but I would influence folk to get hold of this album because it is, as I said, it's a welcome fresh breeze or a new slant on what's happening in the Northeast. Up until now, I suppose we've heard a lot of Bothy ballads, we heard a lot of the Greg Duncan folk song collection, but this is a new era, I think. I'm going to finish off with the Pete Cutton song, as I keep calling it. The story behind that, what's that thing?
Well, New Pit Sligo is, or Pit Sligo, or Kiak, is
Kiak.
That's what folk say, Pit Sligo, Ka Pit Sligo. It's Kiak. Far back as the history of New Pit Sligo, there was peat cutting. That was that was written into the sort of the tenancy agreements that you were allowed to take a certain amount of peat from the surrounding moss for your hearth. And my grandfather cut peats and sell peats. And I think everybody that grew up in the in the other generation would have been cutting peats and would remember the moss and probably remember how much hard work it was.
Each area has their own particular peat cutting implements. If you go up somewhere else in the Northeast, you'll find another type of cutter as well. I didn't know about that until I looked into it.
Well, they're all designed for to cut a certain type of peat for various elements. So you've got a stumper or a stumping spad, and that's to cut stumpers, and that's small peats that fit in a small fire in the home. I'd almost have to sing this song to try and remember it, but the tirring spad is for removing the turf off the top, and then there's a breasting spad, and that's for when you're doing in a ditch and you can using your arms rather than stumping on it to cut the right size of peat. But it was just researching all that and reading about it, and I was just fascinated. And then again, it just kind of came together. I thought that would make a fine song. That
Speaking to the converted, because I'm fascinated by peat cutting as well. I spent a whole summer with a sculptor from Atlanta, Georgia, going around looking at peat bogs.
All right.
And folks saying, "Fitty giddy." I said, "We went around looking at peat bogs and peat implements and things." But it was fascinating. Pete, it's been an absolute delight speaking to you and catching up. Mayor power to you. Here's to the next thing.
Thanks very much.
Pete Coots. And we'll finish with that song in a minute. Yes, what I've been, my cheerioses and thank you users. And remember to tell folk about us. We're Scotch Radio. It's www.scotchradio.com. And I mentioned that sculptor from Atlanta, Georgia. I went around looking at peat bogs. It was George Beasley. And George put on an exhibition, Dave, in Atlanta, Georgia, about all the different drawings and freeze. He made a freeze of the peat bog face, you see, and put it up on the wall, and he had lovely drawings of the peat cutting implements. It was a beautiful exhibition. And he had a tape playing and a loop of me speaking to a great, lovely crofter and singer, Gordon Easton, for Tyree, which is near New Pit Sligo. And we were, of course, speaking about just songs. And as George went round the sheds and Gordon Easton's croft, looking at the peat cutting implements, and George was getting excited in the background, and Gordon and me were still singing a lot of us. And he said, "Do you care anything?" "Aye," we'd sing a bit. "Aye, but I've got another verse for that," and you see. And we're looking up in the hill in Mormon and all the rest of it. So I gave George a copy of this tape, and he played it in a loop. And folk were going to ruin the exhibition in Atlanta, Georgia, saying to George, "Gee, I really love your exhibition, but why have you got the Native Americans talking in the background?" That was me and Gordon. Me and Gordon speaking.
He kind of, just listening to Pete there, it just funny, he goes away back to Muir, he can, and the importance of family and grandparents and passing things on from one generation to another. And then listening here or there and you talking about Pete, I mean, when I went to Inverview as a young gairdner and gone off to cut peats with the Gaelic-speaking people that had been brought up in the area, much older than me, and I have some very deep and very fond memories of that camaraderie that was around.
Is that camaraderie again?
It was cutting beets with Ian the Rug. It's a memory that'll last with me a long, long time.
And I think it was Fred Gordon that told me about the phrase, and George mentioned this as well, as long as the fire shall burn. I think it was Fred was saying that in that glen we were in with Fred, there was a hoose bigot up in the residence, and as long as he got the chimney up, and as long as there was reek coming out the lum, created by Pete, then he had a hoose, he could bide there. And the landlord couldn't have put him off the grun. And that was his hoot. But he had to put it up within a day, and he had to get reek coming out the lum, as long as the fire shall burn, is a phrase I kind of keep remembering and running around my head. Right, that's about it then. Thank you to my studio guest, Davy Mitchell, to your soon starter, Richie Werner. Are you there, Richie?
Oh, I'm here, hello.
Okay, now, here's Richie, the soon starter.
How's
now,
it going?
Last time we spoke, right, you were saying that you were up at Gorgie Farm with your wee baby, and you said that they were needing, Gorgie Farm was needing funds to keep going.
They were having a fundraiser, a big fundraiser.
And we've got news, well, they've managed.
They've made their target, absolutely, and that's going to keep the thing going strong for future generations. So I'm absolutely delighted for my kind of area and everyone around here that they're not going under, you know. So well done everyone that that helped keep them alive.
And it was because you said that on this programme.
That's
the power we have.
The power of the airwaves.
Thanks, maybe we'll raise a fiver. That's it. To me, Freda Morrison. Thank you for listening. By the new. And this is Pete Coots with Casting the Peat.
If there's the thaw, you're up at the crack. Bros in my belly, bull and stump on my back. And down through the den and then o'er the high street. And on to back hill to get cast in the peat. Well, I'm courting a lass, but I'm empty in pocket. Plied by the chine, so it's best to get yocket. But there's time for a laugh with the folks that I meet. Then again on my way to get cast in the peat. Bet spit in your hands and then on with the job. Find sharp tearing spot, will take care of the sod. Whether stickers for the whiskey cutting stumpers or the priest, you'll be up to your cweets in it cast in the peat. Get rowing that barra, 16 stumpers at a time. There's 7 to the rickle, 66 yards to the chine. And a supple caltif and your thirst feels the need. Cause the graft has guided you up and you're casting the peat. Be lousing, I'm full out, in the rinch be the rain. Jump a lift in the bogey so I'm quick to get game. And I'll walk through the tune with my lassie so sweet. And the morn I'll be up again casting the peat.
And the morn I'll be up again casting.
And the morn I'll be up again casting the peat.
And you know that I'll always be casting the peat.